In the past year, the Western world has been shocked by revelations of men of power abusing their positions and sexually abusing the women who depended on them for their livelihood. There is no question that this movement is empowering many women to move from victimhood to an expression of their just anger. It has also, in some cases, given them power to make their abusers answer for their crimes. So how have men responded? Well, the first thing to note is that men do not comprise a monolithic group. Each man responds in his own way. Having said that, there are some trends. Many men have publicly supported the Me Too movement, choosing to support their female colleagues and women in general. Some of these men have turned out to be utter hypocrites who saw which way the wind was blowing and wished only to hide their own past crimes. Don't let that take away from the many men who are genuinely glad to see a redress of past injustices, who see the women in their lives as lovers, colleagues, friends, acquaintances, and fellow human beings, rather than sexual objects or objects of labor placed there for the convenience of men. Many men have kept quiet because they fear the exposure of their own past sins. Enough said about them. Other men keep quiet because they really do not know how to respond. They believe that if they have treated women well and that they have done the best in their lives to treat all people with dignity, but they feel oh so bad about the crimes of other men. If they speak up, they fear being seen as a hypocrite, being accused of something they did not do, or being a target of angry women. Many men have also experienced vicarious guilt and shame, and we'll talk more about that later. Do we then follow the motto of the Possum Lodge on the Red Green Show? Quando omni fluncus moritati. For those of you who do not know, the Red Green Show was a great Canadian show with a satirical look at how men behave in the modern world. Every week there was a bizarre handyman project that always involved copious amounts of duct tape. When we couldn't find the duct tape after my father passed away, we decided he'd taken it with him. Red Green refers to duct tape as the handyman's secret weapon. At the end of the show, they all pile into the basement of the Possum Lodge for a meeting. The pseudo-Latin motto, Quando omni fluncus moritati, according to Red Green himself, means, when all else fails, play dead. This was, after all, the motto of the Possum Lodge. Got it? Red Green goes on to interpret, though, saying, if she didn't see it, it didn't happen. It used to be traditional for men to complain about the power women had over them, even when the men actually had more power. The prevailing paradigm of the past focuses on power and control. It is based on the premise that the only way to be safe and to get what you need and want in the world is to exercise power and control over others. Historically, men have definitely had the upper hand in this because of their greater physical strength and because they believed that the only way to ensure that they were supporting their own genetic offspring was to control the sexuality of women. The extreme expression of this was purdah, where women were kept at home or completely covered while only men could participate in the affairs of society. Some women, too, have sought to redress the power imbalance in the past by passive-aggressive behaviors. You cannot say that any gender as such is in the right or in the wrong. Every individual is responsible for her or his own actions and not those of any of the different identities, associations, or ancestries to which they belong. I was raised by Plymouth Brethren parents who took the Bible very literally. Let me read to you from the Bible, who says that Unitarians don't read the Bible in church. 1 Corinthians 14, verses 34 and 35. Let the women keep silent in the churches, for they are not permitted to speak. But let them subject themselves, just as the law also says, and if they desire to learn anything, let them ask their own husbands at home, for it is improper for a woman to speak in church. And then again, a little earlier, in 1 Corinthians 11, 3, but I want you to realize that the head of every man is Christ, and the head of the woman is man, and the head of Christ is God. Paul goes on to say that woman was created for man's sake, and that she needs to have a head covering in public, so that she has a symbol of authority on her head. As I grew up, this was the ground on which I walked. I assumed that this was the natural order of things, and to dispute it was to dispute God. When I went to the meeting on a Sunday morning, there was always a small stack of head coverings by the door in case any woman forgot this biblical teaching. Fortunately, things changed for me when I lost my faith. It was a good faith to lose. Much of that change then came as a result of later becoming a Unitarian in the 1980s. For me, as for many, if not most men of my era, it was very difficult to wrap my head around what equality of the sexes really means, even when I intellectually believed that it ought to be so. I believe and hope that I will continue to get more insights into what this means as I continue to age, but I do not anticipate that I will ever acquire a complete understanding. The great gender power imbalance of the past has been changing over the past century or so. That change has not been nearly as fast as we would like. When it comes to gender equality, our society stumbles toward the ever-shifting land of utopia. The best ideals of one era morph into the new ideals of another. When Kipling wrote If, that Michael read so well, he was presenting the true and most honorable picture of what it meant to be a man in his time and place. Much of it stands true today and will withstand the test of time. Outside of the reference to gambling, I would make two criticisms of it in the light of today's values. One is the language he uses about ownership of the earth. The other is that some of the qualities that are the best qualities of all humans are ascribed just to men. But that's me in 2018. Judging the values of a man who wrote this poem more than 100 years ago. The point I'm leading up to is that the change in gender roles and the perception of gender roles are together a work in progress. We have most certainly not arrived, nor will we in the foreseeable future, but we have to make sure that we are going in the right direction. The other point I have been leading up to is that particularly for those of my generation, both men and women, we have had to make a huge change to our core identities. Don't forget, we're the generation. I spoke to my grandfather, who saw the first car in England. And the law at the time was that if you're going to drive an automobile through the streets, you had to have a man in front of you waving a red flag to warn everybody that this car was coming. So that's in the living memory of my grandfather. It took a while after that to start, for instance, for women to get the vote. But there have been huge changes in that time. This change is difficult, and we don't always get it right. Good intentions are not, in and of themselves, enough. But they should be factored in as we all struggle together for a more just world. We need to open up the lines of communication. What does it really feel like to be a woman or a man? In what ways are we the same, and in what ways are we different? What actions or attitudes are particularly hurtful or harmful? We need to talk about that. And what changes do we think that we need? If we communicate each other with clarity on the one hand and compassion on the other, we encourage mutual insight. We must then negotiate the changes, the actions that we need. We can accomplish so much more if we work with each other in goodwill than if we engage in a battle of the sexes. I will speak shortly about guilt and shame, but first Theo has some thoughts and hard facts about what men are experiencing today.
There you all are. Wow. Okay. So, I was here last week, and when I was listening to Deborah, her presentation on the Me Too movement, I wondered before she started speaking, will I be triggered? Will I feel angry at her words? I didn't know for sure what the effects would be, but I consciously told myself not to make judgments, to just listen, to open my heart and receive her words as a gift of a different person, a different perception, and a different understanding of my own. So today I'm going to ask the same of you. The issues of men and women are emotionally volatile, and many of us are easily triggered, especially those of us who've experienced abuse at the hands of the opposite gender. So what about men? What has happened to them in this process of gender equality and upheaval over the last 100 years? What are their issues? I've run a men's center on Vancouver Island in Nanaimo for the last 16 years, the only one west of Winnipeg. And what I have seen is more than a little disturbing. Many men are confused, not sure about who they are or how they fit into society, what their role or function is, not sure what to say or what words to use, gender political correctness constantly snapping at their heels. So many men have withdrawn, become depressed at their situations, and many men are being abused too. Let's examine some of the consequences and effects of society's shifting sands. Not just the Me Too movement, but the whole enchilada, all the gender role and social changes which have impacted men over the last century. I'll touch on just a few, and some of the slides will depict a few others. I'll have to skip over some of the slides quickly, as this talk is too short to cover it all. And some of the slides will have way too much information on them for you to be able to read them, but I wanted to put them on there so that you could access them later. I understand they're going to be online. So, and certainly you can get any information from me as well. Men commit suicide 4 times more frequently than women, 8 times more frequently in situations of separation and divorce, and 12 to 1 in situations of separation and divorce for men over 65. In the workplace, workplace fatalities, over 90% are men. Homelessness, 70 to 80% are men. Prostate and testicular cancer, well, we know it's 100% for men. The opioid crisis, 80% are men. Family courts still frequently give custody and primary residence to the mother without just cause. This puts loving fathers on the outside looking in and contributes to an increasing fatherless society. This is truly the most disturbing part of all of this, at least from my perspective. What effect does this fatherlessness have on our children? Research shows that children's social, physical, and intellectual development benefits greatly from the involvement of fathers in their upbringing. To mention just a few, girls raised with involved, nurturing fathers display a greater sense of competency and a secure sense of their femininity, which leads towards healthy relationships with boys and men during their teenage and adult years. Boys raised with involved, nurturing fathers are at far less risk of being excessively aggressive, violent, or exhibiting other antisocial behaviors. Fathers play a major role in helping their children develop a sense of their own competence and independence outside the powerful intimacy of the mother-child dyad. All the indicators show that fatherless children have greater social challenges, drop out of school earlier, use drugs, have teenage pregnancies, have much higher suicide rates, participate in crime or gangs. More than 50% of men in jail have grown up without their biological father. And amazingly, the most reliable predictor of crime is neither poverty nor race, but growing up fatherless. So what are we doing about it? How are we supporting men in their struggle to adapt to a new reality? In Nanaimo, we have a men's center, one of only a handful in Canada. We have extremely experienced, trained, accredited counselors who are available without charge. Our clients come from all corners of the province, including Vancouver, because there are so few resources for men available. We have dads programs and domestic violence prevention programs. We sit on community committees and work with organizations on homelessness and other male challenges. We have a gardening program for seniors. We have created booklets for new dads and a video on parental alienation awareness. We work with the domestic violence court in Nanaimo, a totally unique, innovative, and successful approach to dealing with domestic violence. We work with the inmates at Brandon Lake Correctional Institution, specifically on how to reconnect with their children on their release from jail. We prevent suicide and help reduce domestic violence. So we do all that with government and community support, right? Wrong. We get lots of community and volunteer support, but very little government support. The BC provincial government provides over $100 million annually to women's resources in this province, money which we consider to be very well spent. However, the Men's Center in Nanaimo and other resources for men in this province struggle to simply survive. We are lucky if men's resources receive even 1% of women's funding in any given year. Which brings us to the Me Too movement. There is no doubt that in intimate partner violence, women get hurt 4-1 versus men. Men are usually physically larger, and that is a consequence of those physical differences. As a man, I see the Me Too movement as an expression of all the abused women who have not felt safe or empowered enough to speak out. The court systems in Western society have not adequately created safe spaces for women to be heard. There is definitely a certain justice in the Me Too movement, and definitely some serious male abusers are being held to account. So I support the process of empowerment and accountability. However, many innocent men are very nervous now, afraid constantly to speak or act lest they be accused of something. Can the Me Too movement also be widening the gap between men and women? And what about the male victims of violence? Who is listening to them? Where do they go for help? Accountability is a two-way street. This means that the Me Too movement also needs to be accountable by safeguarding the innocence of some by acknowledging a number of things. Firstly, that all men are not responsible for the actions of some men, meaning not all men are abusers. Secondly, that the courts and society should not necessarily always believe women unconditionally and consequently disbelieve men. that men or privileged groups have a right to speak about Me Too as well. That men as a class are not uniquely or solely responsible for creating and sustaining the gender system that produces sexual harassment. That without due process or the presumption of innocence, major life penalties, such as firing, resignation, and the destruction of reputation, are not appropriate punishments for accused men who have not been found guilty of anything. That the end, justice for women, justifies the means, is not a fair and equitable justice. And that the Me Too campaign does not belong to female victims only. If the same experiences of sexual violence or misconduct occurred to men, those male victims should deserve the same attention and support. Although Deborah and I have had numerous passionate discussions about the Me Too movement, as I'm sure you can imagine, we have different points of view frequently, her homily last week touched me deeply. It opened my heart. I felt empathy for all the women who have been adversely affected by violence. I would ask you to think and feel similarly about all the men who have also been adversely affected by violence. So where now? Is this what we want? A society with no resources and supports for men? A fatherless society? It was my original vision to create a center in Nanaimo which worked with men and women to bridge the gender divide, to work together to create solutions for social and political healing. That vision is not lost, but to have such centers, we need community and, I stress, government support. That means that women need to work just as actively as men to stand up and speak for equality, not just for power. We all need to lobby government, and we all need to make the extra effort to understand and communicate with each other, men and women. We need to rejoice in our gender differences and recognize that we are equal, yet different. We need to hold each other and ourselves accountable for the dance we do with each other. We need to be honest and respect each other's point of view. It's okay to be different. It's okay to disagree. We are all different and a product of a unique life experience. If we can listen to each other, if we can hear each other without judgment, just simply, I hear this is your experience, then we will be 10 degrees closer to healing ourselves and building a bridge over the Grand Canyon of the gender divide. It's the responsibility for all of us to build that bridge. Not only build it, but put flowers on it. Let's make male-female connections bloom again. Thank you.
It on. There we go. I don't know if you heard, Theo, but people were doing this, and that's our way of applauding in church. Thank you so much. I'd like to close with a few thoughts about vicarious guilt and shame. It's a mouthful. These are emotions we feel not because of our own actions, but because of the actions of others. I was watching an English detective series the other day called Broadchurch. In this particular episode, the detective and his female partner were trying to solve a rape. A comment the detective made was quite telling. He said, "It makes me so ashamed to be a man." This brings us to, and I know that you've all been waiting for it, the men's prayer from the Red Green Show. Here it is. Now, all of us who feel like we are men, we're going to stand up right now and say this prayer in unison. Come on, man. All right, here we go. I'm a man, but I can change if I have to, I guess. When Red Green says this prayer, you can see the shame in his face when he says, I'm a man. Oh, what ignominy to be of the same gender as those who have done such truly awful things. Contrary to popular thought, guilt and shame are not useless emotions, and they are not the same thing. If you have done something that you believe to have been wrong and damaging or hurtful in some way to someone else, guilt motivates you to try to repair the damage. Studies indicate that guilt is particularly linked to a desire to confess, apologize, or atone for one's own wrongdoings. When reparations have been made or when time has passed and it is no longer possible to make reparations, guilt no longer serves a useful function. Shame, on the other hand, is that feeling of being judged by others or by society in general. In fact, the reason we experience shame is that it motivates us to conform to the norms of society. Sometimes that is a good thing, and sometimes it is not. Feelings of shame provoke a desire to hide, to disappear, or to escape. Guilt is about what you do. Shame is about who you are. Guilt focuses on actions, while shame globalizes and focuses on who you are. If you are experiencing guilt, you might say, if only I had acted differently. If you are experiencing shame, you might say, if only I were a different person. Now, vicarious guilt and shame are feelings that you get not because of your own actions, but because of the actions of others to whom you feel associated in one way or another. Excuse me. So when Red Green shows shame for being a man, he does so not because of his own actions, presumably, but because of the actions of other men. Is there a place for vicarious guilt and shame? Can they fulfill a positive purpose? With shame, I'm pretty clear, there is little or nothing to be gained by feeling vicarious shame. You are who you are. You are a work in progress and not perfect. If there is such thing as a perfection, which I kind of doubt, and you should not feel guilty that you are any less or feel that you are any less because of the actions of others. With guilt, I don't think guilt is quite the same, because guilt motivates us towards reparations. Ought we to feel guilt for the actions of others? Perhaps not. We all should take responsibility for our own actions. But a certain amount of guilt for the actions of those with whom we identify might motivate us to move toward reparative action, to advocate and take action towards systemic changes, to stand in solidarity with those who have been wronged. Whatever label we put on it, we need to feel bad that people should have to suffer because of the misdeeds of others, and so we need to work towards the changes that are needed. As Unitarians, we believe in the inherent worth and dignity of all human beings. No exceptions. Can we still, as a society or as Unitarians, hold individuals accountable for their actions? Absolutely. At its best, this is what the Me Too movement has done. It has focused the anger of women at injustices done and has already done much to change the attitudes of society. We must hold people responsible for their actions in order to make sure that harmful actions are not repeated and to redress the imbalances of the past. It is possible, however, to do so while still respecting the worth and dignity of victim and perpetrator alike, and regardless of gender or any other identities or associations. The Christian Bible, which has come under fire a bit this morning for the words of the Apostle Paul, quotes Jesus as saying, By this will all men know that you are my disciples, if you love one another. The Unitarian version might be, if we treat each other with deep respect and love, we can be a model. Dare I say a beacon? Yes, a beacon. A beacon to the world of how our society can be made better and of how life can become so much more satisfying. Let us now sing hymn 1023.